Roman,
I have a feeling that it would be very unfair not to give the question to the Ukrainian service at the moment, please.
Thank you. Natalia Chirikova, Ukrainian service. The commitment the Ukrainian leadership made on Monday would not only mean that they would have to steal less or not as fast, which is difficult enough to do in the Ukrainian situation, but it's also it would also mean that the separation of Naftogaz from Ukrtransgaz would mean that they would have to make Naftogaz a more profitable company. And for that, they would have to raise the domestic price. And Ukraine is in the middle of the economic crisis now, so they may want sincerely to raise the prices, but it might be politically impossible. Do you count in this kind of risk, or do you expect this to happen, and what would you do, the European Union, do about it?
Well, quite frankly, I don't expect Europe to do much about it, because Europe is also in the middle of economic difficulty. And, you know, faced with the protests in France and Belgium and elsewhere, and Latvia and Hungary and elsewhere, I don't think that people pay too much attention to troubles elsewhere. We have our own plate full. And, you know, our countries in the eastern part of Europe went through price liberalization of energy in the 1990s and last few years as well. And it's painful. In this country, I mean, ask anyone whether he likes his electricity bill, and you know, you will probably hear a few swear words. Nobody likes that. But there will be no special treatment for Ukraine. I don't believe that. And, you know, when I listened to Mrs. Tymoshenko on Monday, and I spoke with Deputy Prime Minister Nemiria over the weekend a couple of times, they feel hurt by the fact that the IMF package for Ukraine is $16.4 billion, while the package for Hungary, which is a much, much smaller country, is much bigger. And I'm trying to politely explain that that reflects the fact that some countries simply have better standing than others. So don't expect any special deals for Ukraine, no discounts, no favors.
Back to Washington.
I'm Stanley Carver with the Cato Institute. One country that hasn't been mentioned is China. And I understand the Russians also could supply energy to China. Would it have enough? Would it reorient the supplies for China? How does the growth of the Chinese economy and its demand for energy affect Russia's energy supplies for Europe?
This is the favorite line of Vladimir Putin, that if Europe doesn't behave, he will redirect the flow to China. On that, you know, to build the pipelines, the trunk pipelines that could carry the gas from Urengoy and Yambourg to China, you would really have to spend plenty of money on that, tens of billions of dollars. And China can also play hardball pretty well. So Russia will increase its exports of oil to China. That's already agreed, and there is a pipeline being built, the East Siberian Pacific Pipeline to Skovorodino, to be finished. Well, originally was planned to be finished last year, but be finished probably next year. But a whole redirection of the flow, I don't see that happening at present stage. What will happen definitely, that most of the new fields for oil and gas are in the eastern part of Russia, in the Asian part of Russia, North Siberia, Far East. And from there, much of this resource will probably go to countries like Japan, China, or the US and India. That's something Europe has to count with. We mentally think that Russia is our captive supplier, bound by the pipelines to supply to us. I think that we will have to learn that much of the newly discovered and newly opened oil and gas will go elsewhere.
Let's take one more question from Washington, unless our panelists in Washington want to comment.
I'd like to say a few words about one of the consequences of the Ukrainian pipeline EU deal. one thing it will do, if anything, it'll bring greater transparency and greater accountability to the transfer of gas. And this will finally put an end, I believe, to the argument that Mr. Putin and Medvedev have used in the past that Ukraine was stealing Russian gas. The only proven incident of Ukraine stealing gas from the pipeline was back in the 1990s, when the head of Naftogaz Ukraine, a fellow called Ihor Bakai, was stealing gas, selling it on the side to Poland and Slovakia and Romania, and pocketing the money for himself, and bought a very nice property in Naples, Florida, which I visited while recently. Mr. Bakai, then when the Orange Revolution came in, a little before it came to power, Mr. Bakai ran off to Russia, where he was given given Russian citizenship by Vladimir Putin personally for his great work for Russian culture. He's a criminal. And that was the only proven example of Ukraine stealing gas from the pipeline. However, all the accusations in January 2008 by Putin, Medvedev, and others that Ukraine was stealing were never proven, as far as I've seen and heard. Even the EU itself had said that there was no confirmed things. But let me ask you about this. Don't you think that in this kind of a deal, where there would be much greater transparency and accountability, because the EU would look after who's doing what in the pipeline, not the Russians, because the Russians, you can always go to a back room and say, guys, you never saw this, and they say, yeah, of course, we'll split it 10% here, 20% there, and nothing happened. But the EU is going to be quite different, I believe. And I think this will have also a major impact on, corruption in Ukraine, corruption in Russia, and lead to a much more secure gas transportation system into where it needs to go. Let's not forget, by around 2010, the predictions are that the price of oil is going to dramatically rise again. I mean, and there are serious predictions that will go. This means that by the end of 2010, the price of gas will go up if the Russians continue to stick to the current pricing policy. So these things are really liable to come into great changes in the next year and a half, 2 years. How do you see that, sir?
Well, I cannot give you any tip on the price of oil next year. I would love to, but I can't.
I will talk about it later.
Okay.
10% here, 10% there.
You know, when I spoke with my prime minister in December, and I predicted a major crisis in January for gas, and when it finally happened, and we went to Kiev and Moscow, we saw Putin and Yushchenko, Tymoshenko, he kept asking me, the prime minister, he kept asking me, how did you do it? Who did you bribe? How did you do it? So if you want a nice price for oil, let me know. But seriously, the agreement which was signed on Monday may seem maybe more important than it really is, because it's my experience with Ukraine and Russia that any agreement is only worth the amount of goodwill which is on both sides. So I do sincerely hope that Ukrainians are serious about what they signed on Monday and that they really want it. At the same time, I understand that that would mean that quite a few people in Ukrainian elite would lose out plenty of money they are getting at the moment. So we have a Czech saying that fish never dry the pond they live in. I don't know how to translate that to English, but I think it's understandable somehow. And we will see. I mean, what we propose is a clear-cut solution. Accountable, transparent, European, if you will. You will see what it's really interesting for most of the Ukrainian elite. I cannot promise anything. I can tell you just one thing, that until Tuesday last week, 6 days before the conference itself, it wasn't clear that the conference will take place or not. Because there were huge discussions on the Ukrainian side about text, about who should go there, who should not, la 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 la. It was all agreed literally 6 days before the conference, finally, even though the conference itself was planned for months and months ahead. So I see clear fight inside Ukraine between different groups. And I cannot predict who will win.
Let me bring a second supplier here, Turkmenistan.
Thank you. I'm Jamalia Azleva, Turkmen Service. Mr. Ambassador, you mentioned Turkmenistan as a potential supplier for Europe and to extract gas from the newly founded fields in Turkmenistan. The country heavily depends on foreign investment. My question is, where does EU stand in negotiation with Turkmen government at this moment?
Well, our Prime Minister was there recently. We have Sacha Banga going there again in April. And we would very much like to see somebody from Turkmenistan at the summit on the Southern Corridor in May. The present policy in Turkmenistan is clear, and Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov said it clearly a couple of times, that foreigners can invest offshore, but no one from abroad can invest onshore. There is one exception, which is China. And that policy sticks. I spoke with ENI, which is very interested in onshore, and everybody else is interested. I mean, the audit for Yelotan Osman field is tremendous. It seems there is plenty more gas than people thought. But the policy seems to be clear. Nobody is to get onshore. And if you want to try your luck in the Caspian Sea, here is your lot. So unless that change, no investment can come onshore, unless it's Chinese or Russian. That seems to be fixed for the moment.
Would it be the key issue at the summit with Turkmen side?
Look, we have no way of telling anyone you should do this with your natural resource or that. I mean, that's always the free choice of each single country. We do believe that the international oil and gas companies can actually do a more decent deal for Turkmenistan than some other helpers. But in the end, it's for Turkmen leadership to decide.
We have about 10 minutes, so let's take questions from Washington, please.
Richard White, the Hudson Institute. I'd like to follow on to the previous question and flip it around and ask how the Central Asian countries, particularly those that supply energy to Europe, have been viewing the recent conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Well, I've been to Kazakhstan recently, and I'm going to Turkmenistan soon again. Those people usually, especially the people who are in the gas and oil business in those countries, understand very well how complex the relationship between Russia and Ukraine is. You know, how many people have their hands in the pie, both in Moscow and Kiev. And they usually just smile when I talk about it with them. And how do they see it? I think the real message for that region was August 2008. The real message to Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan was the war in Georgia. And the message was clear. If you bypass us, you might get hurt. And they understand. I was in Kazakhstan last year, a few weeks after the war, and it was just in time when Kazakhstan announced that it will pull out from three investments in Georgia, which it had planned. No official explanation, just simply, it wasn't economically interesting anymore. And Azerbaijan asked right in September after the war, suddenly to be able to ship oil via Makhachkala pipeline through Russia. pipeline, which it didn't use since finishing of the Bakut-Bezi-Jaihan pipeline. So they also get the message. And we will see. Europe can offer decent terms, cooperation, not just in energy, but in transport and other fields. But of course, we have no divisions at our disposal and no fleets of bombard planes. So there is something that we don't have, obviously.
Let's take another question in Washington, please.
Raise an issue here. Well, I'd like to return just quickly to the issue of kind of a coalition, because I'm taking a look at the €5 billion energy infrastructure money, which is just being dispersed now. The only project in East Central Europe which is on there is a firm project, is a power line between Poland and Sweden. And the money that was originally designated for the Nabucco pipeline is shrinking or will go away. And so I go back to the point is that I don't think that the interests of East Central Europe, and in fact, are being adequately addressed in the EU Commission. If I look at the EU Commission, I look at what they've been doing as far as on pipeline issues over the last few years. They've been, quite frankly, very passive when it comes to pipeline issues. When was the first time that the Commissioner for Energy went to Azerbaijan to talk to the Azeris about Nabucco? Very recently. And when the president of the EU was in Azerbaijan, the Azerbaijanis at least report that he was not interested in the issue. So it's only been recent that there's been any interest at all. And there's been very little follow-up as far as White Stream. So quite frankly, I think that those countries who feel more pressed, not the Czech Republic, obviously, but those countries who feel more in a bind on energy and their dependence on Russia, are I think legitimately have a legitimate beef against the European Commission. That's
well,
what.
If I may on this one, I watched carefully what was going on with those money, because it was originally assigned in October to be $5 billion out of those $200 billion for the reconstruction, $5 billion for energy, and then the money constantly shrank. Because then in December already it was just $4 billion, the $1 billion going to internet broadband. Then there was more money going to internet broadband and countryside. So in the end, what was agreed last week is €3.5 billion. And I can assure you that much of this money will not be spent. Because as I said before, it would have to be spent this or next year. And most projects are not prepared for this. What I see as a more depressing thing is that the reason why the mixture of the projects in the end is such as you mentioned, and you're pretty right on that, Ambassador, is that what most EU new member states lack is the know-how how to deal in the corridors or in Brussels. How you get your things on the list, how you keep them there, how you get your projects 100%. Funded. That's something that the French and Italians and Germans know much better than we do. I mean, they've been at it for five decades now. We are just learning slowly how to do the stuff. So I am very often exasperated by our own state service, which could be much better, I believe. And I could be much better myself in getting the money to my country. And I see deficiencies on our side very clearly, because sometimes it really is that we are not just as good in grabbing attention and grabbing the money as others are. And that's our great, something we have to catch up with pretty fast. I have nothing more to say about that. When I see the list, it's clear. There are small projects there, a connection between Bulgaria and Greece is there. There are some other smaller projects there. But in the end of the day, we are pretty bad in grabbing the stoppages on offer. We could do a much better job as new Europeans, if you will.
Martins, do we want to continue with questions?
We've got one more question, and then let's go to wrap up here.
Tomas Gulbinas, Lithuanian Embassy. Sorry, in DC. Well, thank you very much for the panelists here and in Prague for a very interesting discussion. Well, being here for a couple of years, I heard many times that Americans were kind of encouraging EU to take steps on energy independence and were caring more probably for European energy independence than the Europeans themselves. Now, with this deal on Monday between EU and Ukraine, it looks like EU made a very significant step, upsetting Russia, strongly upsetting Russia. And this comes in the middle of a honeymoon between Washington and Moscow. Looking forward to the EU-US summit, what will be your message to the Americans and what you expect from Washington? Thank you.
Well, I was in D.C. a month ago, and I'm going there soon again. And I think pretty much everybody in the new administration is more worried about getting the clearance and confirmation than everything else. So we don't expect any new clear policies before the end of our presidency. And that's the usual stuff with all new administrations. And I was at the White House in February. Everybody had a green badge, you know, awaiting confirmation. Almost everybody there. And so we don't expect any major new policy formulated in the summit meeting in April. And also, I think that the U.S. will have to do their reviews, which are plenty of them conducted at the moment. And we will see. We will also see how far the honeymoon, as you called it, the honeymoon with Russia, how far it goes. I think that there might be some honeymoon between Moscow and Washington at the moment, but I think there is more ground for a long-lasting love between Europe and the U.S. than U.S. and Russia. So we will see. But I don't expect anything new in April. No, it's too soon. It will be very polite, very nice, family photo and all that, but probably nothing major will happen here.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Washington. Thank you, Ambassador Smith. Thank you, Roman. And thank you, Ambassador Bratushka. It was a terrific discussion. I think we all learned a lot and all benefited from this an hour and a half that we spent together. Thank you.
Thank you.